Welcome to But Why Though, the podcast, a roundtable conversation about all things pop culture. I'm your host, Alex, and I'm joined this week by Kate.
Hi.
And new to the show, Kyle Foley.
Hey.
Kyle is a writer at But Why Though. He actually, your review, is it already up? It's up by the time this episode goes up, right?
Oh, yeah, it's been up.
Yeah, it's been up. Okay, so this week we are talking about Formula One. Not the movie, it'll come up, but that's not the whole thing. We're talking about it as a sport, its rise in popularity, cultural perceptions, all that stuff. If you've listened to this show, you know how we usually break things down, and that's what we're going to do with Formula One racing. But before we get into that, what have you guys been enjoying this week?
I think if I go first, I'm going to say magic.
Tell me more.
So I have been a recently converted magic girly. I've been playing magic for about 2 years. I came in with the Lord of the Rings set, but I wasn't taking it serious. I wasn't making my own decks. You would not catch me in a card shop. This week alone, I've played 4 commander sessions. And I went to a card shop yesterday, a local. It's called Outlaw Moon Cards and Games. If you're in Austin, it is fantastic. I sold some cards for in-store credit. I bought snackies and some more Final Fantasy booster packs. So I feel like I'm doing pretty good with not spending money on magic.
Yeah.
But we'll see how long that lasts. And yeah, I'm just really excited to be playing Magic right now. The Final Fantasy set came out. I have a really great interview with his first name's Daniel. Forgot his last name. Apologies. But he was the lead designer on the Commander decks. But more specifically, our interview is just about the Final Fantasy 14 Commander deck. That Commander is Ystola, Goth Cat Mommy. She's fantastic. It is also the strongest deck that they did, pre-builds that they did for Commander. And a fun fact that I learned while doing the interview is there are actually more Final Fantasy 14 cards in the entire Final Fantasy set than there are of any other Final Fantasy. Yes, it even has more than Final Fantasy 7. So it's really cool. I think right now is a good time to get in if you are. Go to your local card shop to buy things because it is being a lot of scalpers are gouging the price like crazy, but you can still get stuff at your local shop. So
beautiful. What about you, Kyle? What have you been into?
I'm fighting the urge to get really heavy into magic because I keep seeing people like Kate post about how awesome the Final Fantasy decks are, but I've been playing a lot of Death Stranding too. I've really been enjoying that and diving into like the soundtrack and just kind of the experience. It's been nice to go through just like probably a mission a day, just kind of sit and peacefully enjoy it.
Nice. Yeah, it's one of those games like when I played the first one where what I appreciated was I could absolutely marathon it. I could sit down and play for like 3, 4, 5 hours, or I could pop in, do a mission, be like, all right, that's all I have time for today, I'll come back to it tomorrow. Unless and this is because it's a Kojima game, it's nothing against Death Stranding specifically, if you hit a section with a bunch of cutscenes and then you're like, all right, I guess I'm gonna be here for 2 hours. But again, that's a Kojima thing. Does he still have the record for longest cutscene in a game where it was basically a movie?
I believe so. I would be floored if anybody has come anywhere close to him.
Right. It's incredible. Kate, do you have thoughts on Kojima's cutscenes?
Kojima isn't for me.
That's fair. I get it.
I have met him one time at South By. He's a weird little dude who loves movies, and more power to you. Just not for me.
That's fair. I get that. I have a friend who he doesn't like Kojima, and I'm like, that's fine. But part of it is, at least I think we've talked about it, and then it's one of those things that we don't talk about as much anymore, is that Kojima isn't subtle. And I'm like, I don't think he's trying to be subtle. Like, I don't think he's like, look how clever I am naming a character Die Hardman. Like, I think he knows what he's doing. I don't think he thinks that he's being clever with any of that.
Yeah.
But anyway, for me, what I've been enjoying this week is, do y'all know about Crow Country?
Yes.
Okay, so I've heard about it. Like, it came out a year ago, and I'd heard about it. It's a modern game, PS1 era graphics, survival horror, very much of that era, set in an abandoned theme park. I think the whole game is like maybe like 5 to 8 hours long, depending on what mode you're playing on and how good you are. But I have just been delighted by it. I'm not gonna say it's like a super hard game. I'm playing on just the default difficulty, and like some enemies are a little spongy, but other than that, it's doable. And even that, the game is pretty forgiving about like you can run past things. Like obviously, if you do that too many times, an area will get overcrowded, but you can get around. But yeah, I've been enjoying that. It also, I haven't tried it yet. There's an exploration difficulty level where all the monsters are pulled out and it's just the puzzles. Which what I want to do is my 8-year-old niece has been watching me play this game off and on. And I kind of want to be like, here, you play it on this mode there. You don't need to worry about shooting things. You just need to solve the puzzles. Like, let's remove all the stress of trying to stay alive and you can just do all the puzzles, because that's the part of this that you're into. But yeah, Crow Country, it's just fun. If you want like a good, quick little survival horror throwback title, I highly recommend it.
Yeah, I think Crow Country was one of those games, came out last year, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was one of those games that was like in that vein of like small indie horror that I think deserved more love. I mean, it got love towards the end, but it was after award season was gone. That, yeah. And Mouthwashing were the two that are like.
Oh, yeah. Well, I would say Mouthwashing hit hard and like out of nowhere like that. Yeah. I get it. But yeah, because I think Crow Country is also one of those games where it was like, you know, three people in a garage more or less making it. I don't know if that's the actual exact number, but it was, yeah, small team, like labor of love, but it's a fun game. I like it. I think it's great. But yeah, I think that's all I got for this week. So thank you guys for your recommendations. Kate, much like Kyle said, like I do constantly have to resist getting into Magic, because like I see you and other people posting about it and I'm like, I don't have the time, money, or mental energy for this, but I want to because I like games. And so no, it is a constant
it's
struggle.
Hard. And to be honest, like, and we will have a podcast on here later talking about like the universes beyond sets and their pros and cons. But I think for me, like Magic has always been something that I've been interested in as a mm-hmm. Yu-Gi-Oh kid, but it was always too intimidating to enter. And so mm-hmm. when the universe beyond sets like Lord of the Rings or Final Fantasy happened, it was a way for me to connect with the property in like a real personal way. That really got me going. Like, I don't think if I had gotten sent the Shola deck, like if I had gotten sent Terra, Cloud, or Titus, I'm never going to call him Titus. You can fight me personally. He's no. Unless titties. Yeah. Okay. Not that either. Okay. You know what? Titus or Titus, only if the words titties is following it, but it is Titus otherwise. I don't think I would have snowballed into it the way that I did, but because it's a Yishola deck and the entire crux of her deck, it's job select. Like mm-hmm. there's Reaper weapons, there's Paladin arms, there like Reaper Scythe, Paladin arms, it just hits different. There's a card that when you play it and you give extra mana, you summon that many heroes. And then you have a light party and a full party mechanic based on the number of creatures on your board. Like it, like the intelligence with which they adapt in-game mechanics is something that I am consistently floored by.
That is cool. Now, I have a question off of that. Not that this is not our Magic episode, but I just have, as someone who has not played Magic since like the early 2000s, what's the pace of the meta?
It depends on who you're playing.
Okay.
Like, I just did a Commander game that like almost went to 3 hours, but it is also
how often does the meta change?
Oh, not that much, honestly. Okay, at least what I have felt.
Yeah.
Because one of the ways that they do that is a lot of the sets, you will have brand new cards, but mm-hmm. a lot of them are reskins of existing cards.
Okay,
so,
cool.
Like, one I play is, I think it's called Authority of the Console. That's mm-hmm. in my deck. It's one of my favorite cards, but it's just a reskin of Council of Authority, which was old as shit. Yeah. So it's one of those where I think that like the meta change isn't as frequent as you would think for as many sets as they put out per year.
Okay. Yeah. Cause I know one of my friends who was playing the Pokemon trading card game app, and he ended up just kind of quitting cause the meta changed basically every time they put out a new set of cards. It was like any old strategies that you have out the window because the new cards are and it's like, to me, that's not fun, especially like if you're playing Magic with real cards and spending money. Like, I don't want to have to rethink my strategy every single pack. Like, maybe incorporate a few new cards, but not like, let's do a ground up rebuild.
Yeah, and I think that that's like the important thing from it is that because there's reskins, you end up in a situation where you don't just, you're not just reaching forward, you are oftentimes reaching back. Like my friend who I've been playing Magic with consistently, he was like, oh, I have a bunch of old cards that work really well with your deck that you have now and that will work to counter certain things. So I think that they have done a fairly good job. And obviously I'm new. If you were an existing Magic player seething at this, I'm sorry, I'm baby, deal with it. But I haven't had an issue. Okay. And the people I know who have been playing since the 90s also haven't had issues, or at least vocalized them to me. So,
all right, that's a good sign. Yeah, I'm on board. Cool. Well, thank you guys for those recommendations again. Where can people find you online?
You can find me being annoying as shit over on Blue Skies Omimith Randir. I am posting about Magic a lot and my eyeliner because I learned how to do big ass wings now. Nothing can hold me back.
You are unstoppable now.
Yes, the power, like, this is the reason I was made short, because if I was like one of those 5'6", 5'7" ladies, I'd be too powerful.
Absolutely. Kyle, what about you?
I'm over on Blue Sky as well, K Foley, F-O-L-E-Y-F-L, where you can also see posts about my eyeliner. No, I'm just kidding.
I was going to say, would you also be unstoppable if you unlocked wingtips and were a little bit taller?
I would be. I think I would be truly unstoppable. I mostly just post about books and video games and sports. F1 most often now because it's in season. But yeah.
Yeah. And you can find me on Blue Sky at Most Always Alex. And I think there I just post my own stupid thoughts and then repost other people's good thoughts about current events and things like that. And then all of mine are things like, hey, how come in Speed he says that the elevator bomb was his life's work, but then he just has the bus bomb plan like locked and loaded and ready to go the next day, which was arguably the significantly better plan. Anyway, all that aside, we can actually use Speed as a segue. Let's talk about fast cars. Let's talk about Formula One. Quick, I guess, like, show of hand, like, what's everyone's like experience with or love of Formula One racing or racing in general?
I can start before Kyle talks because I don't really have a big love of it. Funny. So like, I'm very interested in watching what people do because I don't understand how turning left is a sport. I have my mind has changed a little bit because I have seen like the like how much you have to teach your body to respond to force as you turn. So you actually do have to be really fit. But then there are movies like The Gentleman Driver, where it's just somebody who paid $10 million to have a car in an F1 race. And I'm like, ah. But I did go to a NASCAR race this year. And I get the appeal. I get the appeal sitting in that stand and feeling the truck, like the cars go by. I was like, oh, it kind of reminded me how I felt with watching baseball versus going to my first baseball game. Like it was very different in person.
Oh, absolutely different.
So yeah, I don't have like a lot of love for it, but I have found myself wanting to know more about it after I went to that NASCAR race. And so I've been watching things like Drive to Survive. And I think it's crazy too, because like I like racing games. Like Forza is probably one of my favorite games. Growing up, my cousin's boyfriend was a drifter, so I was in his drift car a lot. Very scared for my life. So I would say that like I always liked street racing, but like NASCAR, Formula One, like that was never something that like ever seemed geared towards me, I will say.
That's fair. Yeah, I have been to a local stock car race that my grandpa took me to because he liked NASCAR and liked like, stock car racing. And I was like, I don't see the appeal. But when I went, I was like, yeah, this actually is fun. I had a great time. Ate a churro, sat in the stands, watched fast cars go fast. It was an awesome day. And I have been in one of my friend's dad owns a retired practice car that was used in NASCAR. And we went to the racetracks and I got to sit passenger in that while he took it around the track. And that was cool. And that's as close as I've got to NASCAR. Formula One, I actually know not a lot of firsthand experience. I did research for this episode, but like I have not sat down and watched a race from start to finish is my familiarity. I'm more familiar with the NASCAR side of this, which will be part of the conversation. But Kyle, what do you know about F1?
I am an absolute sicko. I get up like when they race in China and the qualifying is at 2 o'clock in the morning. I get up for it, get up for the race at 3 a.m. even when they get rained out. And it's just a horrible, I'm just like prying my eyes open to watch. I am a sicko. I watch the feeder series Formula 2 and occasionally Formula 3. If I'm really feeling like a sicko, I've been really, really into it. Really since the pandemic, getting into Drive to Survive was kind of my segue into it. And then I've just been like, I will read technical like analysis of car parts, even though I'm not an engineer and I don't know. I will read that stuff just to try to learn more because it's such a fascinating sport. And the way it's not just the driver skill, but it's the engineering that goes into it. And hey, you know, they made a 0.2 degree change to the wing and it's shaving off this amount of time. And like these are the margins that they deal in. It's just it's so fascinating to me.
Cool. Yeah, I think that was something that kind of, as I was like learning more about this, that I thought was interesting was how much the engineering is a component. Like, it's not just about the pit crew. It's not just about the driver. It is, it's like, what are you even, like, what's your machine? So to kind of go back in the history, F1 started in 1950. That's the first season of this entire race. These are open wheel, single seat cars. And these are on circuits or closed roads. Some of them are like a little bit simpler. I don't remember which specific one it is, but there is one where it's like basically two long lanes going either way and then turns at the end. Like it's as close as you can get to like the NASCAR oval. But a lot of them are more complicated or literally on real streets that have been closed for the race. They're like specific tracks. They're approved tracks. Grand Prix have whole requirements around what tracks can be used. Which, and also, do you want to, Kyle, maybe shed some light on what the Grand Prix structure is? Like, how those work?
Yeah, so, like, every weekend, there's an upcoming race. A week ago, there was a race in Austria. Now they're going to be racing in England. What happens is they come in on the week, they get 3-hour-long practice sessions where you get to come in and try out the car, running it on different fuel loads, different types of tires, maybe occasionally bringing in a test driver to figure things out. But there's like a bit of gamesmanship, right? You don't know what fuel level they're running. So, hey, this team that was a front runner is running pretty low. We don't really know what's going on. There's a little bit of gamesmanship going on there. And then it goes into qualifying, which is 3 different sessions. There's 20 drivers currently on the grid. Next season, there will be 22 with the new Cadillac team coming in. Mm. And after the first, so it's 15 minutes, get the fastest lap that you can. After the first round, the bottom 5 drivers get knocked out. The next round, next 5, and then the top 10 qualify to see where they start in the race. Pole position is starting in first. And then ultimately, the top 10 drivers in the race, which is typically on a Sunday, the top 10 drivers earn points, which go towards both the Drivers' Championship, which is the individual drivers competing for their individual championship, and also there are 10 teams with 2 drivers each, and the points also combine to add into the what's called the Constructors Championship, which is the teams then competing against each other as well.
Okay, that's good to know. I knew about the 2 driver thing, but I wasn't quite sure how that worked out for the points and the rankings and everything. But yeah, this is like, this sport's been around 75 years at this point, and I feel like America has just discovered it in the last 5. As I dug into it, that's not without reason. I think the big thing, and Kyle, correct me if I'm wrong here, was that Liberty Media, which is an American company, acquired Formula One in 2017.
Yeah, it was always like for racing fans that were really into racing, it was always popular. There've been races in the United States for decades, in different points in time. Mario Andretti won the world championship. He drove as an American driver. I think he won in like the 70s though. So it hadn't been in the mainstream. And then when Liberty Media came in and bought, they were really focused specifically on reaching out to the North American audience. Mm-hmm. And it has exploded almost kind of overnight, just over the last a little bit under a decade since they've taken over.
Yeah. I think one of the things I saw was that they bought it and they were like, all right, let's loosen up the rules around like posting clips online and posting content, and like actually it would be good for us to post content and to be accessible and available, which like that's like a whole part of this conversation is like, why didn't America know about it? It's like, well, we didn't have a ton of great avenues to know about it. Like we, you know, until I think, you know, like the 2000s when specialty channels really took off and exploded, like I don't know that there that I knew where to watch races other than like ESPN, you know. But yeah, it basically like they just, from my understanding, is like they swooped in, bought it, and they're like you were saying, let's invest in reaching this market, like let's grow the fan base, and that was the whole thing. And so how do they do that? We get 2019, we get Drive to Survive, which that's still going, right? That's like 8 seasons in.
Yeah.
Okay. And Kate, you said you started that one.
Yeah, I started watching it. Yeah. How? I the one that I finished. Well, sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say how have you been liking it? Like, do you like the no, overall
I,
everything?
I really like it because like the thing is like I'm a competitive person. And so for me, when I get to see people talk about what they view as their sport and what is their sport, I get invested. Because I want to know what they have. It's the same thing with esports, right? Like we covered Counter-Strike tournament here in Austin. And I when I first started going to esports matches, it was one of those like, oh, what's this? And then you actually get in there and you see the mentality, like the mental fortitude and the resilience that these players have. While they may not be using their bodies in the same way, it is still a sport. They're still competing. And I just like competition. So yeah. I think what Drive to Survive did for me was kind of put that into perspective, because my first, like I knew of Formula One because of Forza and Gran Turismo and like these games that have always been in my life. And then I watched, what's the name of the show with the two British guys in the car? Top Gear. Yeah. I love Top Gear. And so like that was the doorway. And then Austin got the Circuit of America's track here. So it's always been here. But I think MotoGP was the first one that I actually looked at and like watched. I have yet to watch a Formula One race, but Drive to Survive has done a lot to show me the mentality of somebody who is actually racing. And I think that seeing that makes sense. But I actually think that it was F1 Academy is what actually, I think, brought me in more than Drive to Survive. Because that one specifically is with young women who are racing in F4, which, Kyle, please explain the difference to all the Fs, to become future Formula One drivers. Mm-hmm. And there's the added pressure of, like, I think only one woman has won anything in an F1 race ever, and women just aren't in the sport. So they're having the weight of being a woman in a not even male dominated, but pretty much a male only environment. So if they lose, they're not just making themselves look bad. They're making all women look bad. And that is very prevalent as you watch that series. But the way they talk about it, how angry they get, how aggressive they get when they drive. Like, I think that actually did more to up what I had watched in Drive to Survive, which I'm only on season 2 now. I heard that it gets more intense the farther in it goes because they kind of know how to shoot the drama better. But yeah, that's where I am. Yeah.
Just really quickly diving into like what the different types of things are. There's Formula One, which is like, that's the pinnacle. That's like the absolute top. That is a completely, like, you're completely developing your cars independently. There's like an overall guideline and rules you have to be within, but there's so much freedom to explore how you want to design your car. So it's the ultimate test of like your car design and your driver's ability. You have Formula 2 and Formula 3, which are just the kind of the two lower tiers. Those are spec series, so every car is the same. So it's really just a test of how good are the drivers. So there's a lot more, there's more of a difference in how many race winners there are, what the points are scored. There's a lot more variety there. It's more just down to, obviously, your team has to make decisions. There's minor setup changes you can make, but not a ton. Formula One Academy is really interesting because, like Kate said, it's the all-female version. It's in its own category. It's not quite up to Formula 3, but it's also not quite to the lower levels of like some of the other Formula series they have that are more regional. This one does like a handful of races at the F1 tracks. The last, I had to look this up just to confirm, the last time a female has ever, or the only time a female driver has ever scored even a point in Formula One was in 1975. And the last time there was a driver was in 1992 in 3 different entries, very minimal driving time, not actually starting races and competing. The last competitor was Lola Lombardi in the 1970s. So it's been, I know it's run by Susie Wolf, who's the wife of Mercedes team principal Toto Wolf. And the whole point is she was a driver herself. And the whole point is there's not a lot of access to getting into the sport. It's such an expensive sport to get into. You've got to have the money to get into karting at a young age. Then you have to have the money or the sponsors or the connection to get into these other tiers that go up the ladder. So the point of F1 Academy has been, how do we give access to these drivers that might not otherwise have access? And then with the series that they did on Netflix, which I think actually that series has done much better than Drive to Survive. And I say that as someone who enjoys Drive to Survive, but it shines a really good light on who these drivers are and just how demanding what they are doing is, even though you're not hearing a lot about their races on social media or on different sports networks or whatever. It's not talked about as much, but you see that and you start to realize, oh, this is really, like Kate said, you learn about the competitors and how much it means to them, and you really get an appreciation for what it is that they're doing. And obviously the weight of trying to become a full-time driver in Formula One, where all the odds are stacked against you systemically. You just don't have the same access. You don't have the same resources. There's not the same. And there is a little bit of an old school mentality of, you know, oh, I don't know if women can do this. So the fact that all of the current Formula One teams are invested and operate, I believe, one car per team in the F1 Academy series. So there's a lot of genuine, it's not just, oh, hey, wouldn't this be cool? There's a lot of genuine investment in this, that if we were to see a driver in the next 5-10 years make their way to that level, it wouldn't be surprising because they're actually putting in the work.
I think that was one of the things that I thought was really striking, was hearing hearing the top woman, I forgot her name because she wasn't, like, she's surprising, like, she's running all of F1 Academy, but she really wasn't the focus. Like, you are focusing on all of the young women who are in it. But when she's talking about it, like, there's a, I think it's like towards like the mid of the season where, you know, one of them is going to get cut. And she's just like, these, like, we have top tier investment from these brands and they want top tier talent. And you get to see that there is literally no room for error. Like, one of the top drivers starts having bad races and McLaren's like, get the fuck out of here. Like, you're not top. Sorry. And I think that weight that comes with it just feels different. But it was also just interesting too, is just like seeing the cars they have, which are much smaller, right, than real F1 cars.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, they're much smaller, just like, and seeing how those are, it's interesting. I'm definitely more interested.
Yeah, and I mean, even just hearing that there is that investment, it's, you know, it's interesting to see that they are trying to grow the sport beyond just its fan base, but also, like, they want to grow the popularity for participants. Although it's a little bit tricky because, like you said, there's like, this is a high barrier to entry as far as cost. But seeing that there is still like some interest in, like, you know, hey, let's see what we can do to build this out. I appreciate that. Especially in something that it would be so easy to shut the doors and let it be, you know, a boys club. And like, if you're not in, too bad. So that part's really interesting to me. I think also, as you were talking about this, something that struck me is, I think part of the appeal, from my understanding of what I've seen online, just like being on Reddit or whatever and having like Formula Dank make it to the front page, is other sports have this, football has this, basketball has this, but the personalities and the driver, and like, it's like, these are people, these are characters, these are, you know, like, yes, you know, like the star players from different teams when you're watching team sports, but like, you don't know the whole roster. But F1 is so small that, like, you know, the whole you know everyone who's on the track, and you know you can follow their interviews and not get inundated. And I think that's a really interesting thing that we don't see as much in American sports. Like, if you're not, like, if somebody's not watching basketball, they can name like two players, and if they are watching basketball, they can name like 20 players. And that is like, is that even a full bench at that point? Like, and that's selling basketball fans short, but like, you get what I mean? Like, there's just, it's so much easier to track and to follow. And I think that's something that we don't necessarily see in other sports. But also, am I, you know, talking out of my ass here? Like, does that track for you and your experience?
Yeah, I think it's a really accurate way. There's a lot more, it's a lot more accessible to understand who these different competitors are, not only the drivers, but also the people in their teams, the team principals, who are essentially kind of the head coach of the team. And there's a lot of, it's not just obviously through Drive to Survive, it's great because you're getting all these moments on and off the track from these people. You're getting to see their everyday lives, you're getting to see their different experiences, but also during the race you get access to the radio broadcast of the teams, of the drivers and their teams communicating to each other. They'll pop them up on screen whenever there's anything interesting. They'll interrupt the broadcast to show it. If you subscribe through F1 TV, you can actually go on and like see like the live updates. Like everything is out there to see, and because it's only 20 drivers, if you want to pick like, hey, I'm following this team, you're only paying attention to one or two drivers. You don't have to, but you can be aware of what's happening with everybody else without, like you said, being overwhelmed with the sheer amount of stuff that there is to pay attention to. So it's, mm-hmm. it's kind of bite-sized chunks in only having to pay attention to a certain amount of things, and an unprecedented level of access to them, not just off the track, but also in the moment, being able to see and hear what they're going through.
For sure. Yeah, it's making me think of when I was following football more closely and you would hear like so-and-so sprain their ankle and you're like, okay, so what role do they play on the team? Who else do they have that can fill that? What other players are out right now? Who are they going up against? Who does that team have missing? And it's like, that's a lot of calculus for you to have an idea of how your team's going to do. Whereas with F1, it's just like, oh yeah, he has the flu, so the other guy's racing. Like, it, you know, it's so much easier to get a handle on. Which to me, I mean, I'm like talking myself into liking F1. Like that, I'm like, I should go get into this because this sounds like my kind of accessible sport.
Honestly, like I really do like hearing the in-house, like the in-car talk, like the communication between them and their pit, or like their is it a coach, manager, coach?
The team principal, or I guess a lot of what you're hearing on there is their race engineers.
Okay, yeah. No, like I really love it. I think it adds something to it that you just don't normally get. Like you just don't get just seeing it, because you can mm-hmm. you can hear the tension, you can hear the annoyance. Like, and you can also just like hear, I don't want to say when they've given up, but you can hear when they've given up, and you can hear when they're digging in. And I think that that is something that's really fascinating. And I also think just like there's like an element of boredom that I do have with like rooting for someone, and then once the snowball starts, like they are probably never going to come back. But like you stay with them when you still hear them giving it their all in a way that I think is really interesting. Yeah. And again, I feel like I got that more out of F1 Academy, and I think that people should go watch F1 Academy.
I will watch it.
Yeah, you should. The model for that, honestly, like it's really impressive that they did it so much better than Drive to Survive. And I don't mean that as a knock on Drive to Survive, just the way F1 Academy handles diving in. It's the thing for me is it's not trying to manufacture drama. It's trying to tell their stories. Whereas like Drive to Survive, if you're a hardcore racing fan and you watch all the races, you could tell like, oh, they're talking about this but showing this from a different race, and things are edited different ways, and that happens. Like that, I don't personally think there's anything wrong with that. In it's just they're telling a story. If you want to watch all the nitty-gritty details, watch all the races, which is a great way to enjoy the sport. But F1 Academy is really just, here are these drivers, this is their experience, this is what's going on with them personally and as a driver. And there's just so much more. It feels like you're in the room experiencing what they're going through. And so it's so much easier to get attached and have that personal connection with it because you're seeing these people. And I think it helps too that their races. Yeah. And they're not as big of celebrities, obviously, as the Formula One drivers. So it does feel that like they're not trying to just put on a performance for the cameras. They're trying to sell themselves to people. Like, look at who I am and how hard I'm working and how much I want this.
And I think it got me past like the barrier, which is like, this is a rich people thing. Like, why am I here? This is dumb. Like, not like dumb, but just like, this isn't for me. Like the cost to enter here is too high. This is something that just is impractical in every single way, shape or form. And I think what F1 Academy did was it kind of pulled it down into perspective and also shows like, what is the sport when it's reaching back, and like, can it be something that does expand? Cause not all the girls there are well off. Some of them really are, like the two sisters that are driving, but some of them aren't. And I think that like there is something to be said for making it more approachable, because I do think that that is that MotoGP, like that type of stuff, like that is what keeps it inaccessible. And I think that that's one of the reasons why F1 has taken off here in Austin is like we have like the McLaren like dealer here. Like we have like the really high end stuff. Like you go to North Austin in the Domain and you'll just see fucking McLarens parked in the. I'm just like, why would you do that? Put it in covered parking. One, two, what the hell? But they sell. Because they also use it for NASCAR, they have a really, and concerts, they have giant green spaces where it's like 10, 15 bucks a ticket that you just go and like BYOB, bring chairs and just sit and watch. And that's something that I think is really cool. But like, I think even then, like a lot of people don't know that you can do that. So.
Yeah. That's fair. And yeah, I wanted to go back to something that you had said, Kyle, of like the show making it a point to show how hard they're working. Because I think with all motorsports, the thing at the end of the day is that people are like, I could do this. And like I know how to drive a car. And no, you don't. You don't know how to drive a car like that. And I think that that's part of what I like about show that it showcases the drivers is that you get a feel not just for them as people, but like you get a feel for like, oh, this actually is like a lot harder. Like there is a whole like calculus that they are doing the whole time they're racing of like, how do I hit this corner? When do I do this? When do I pit stop? I don't know if it's the same in F1, but I know in NASCAR, there's even the question of like, well, do I swap out two tires or four tires? And if I'm doing two tires, like is the guy with the fuel can going to be able to get enough fuel off before I have to leave? And like all these kinds of things that you're just like, you think you know how to drive a car. You can't hit a corner going that fast without dying. You will go into the wall. And so, yeah, I think that it's a good way to get people both interested and humbled, to have that recognition. I think on top of that though, of not just the driver skill is, and you had talked about it earlier is like the engineering component of this is fascinating. Like the way you described F1, I assume it kind of sounds like when people joke about like, let's do an Olympics where people can do steroids and we just see what happens. And I feel like that's sort of what F1 is where they're like engineer, like here's some like loose parameters, but like go fast, figure out how to go fast, figure out how to not die.
Yeah. And it's all sorts of like, so much of it is unseen. It's like, oh, we have a new underfloor for the car that nobody's ever going to see unless we crash and it gets picked up by a crane. And
there was some dude was like in AutoCAD crafting that and running simulations for like
spending hours and hours and hours like in the wind tunnel testing things out. And the fact that they spend all this time and they do all this and they have all this technology, and you get to the race, you don't know for sure if it's going to work. And so you'll see that they're trying new things and trying to figure out, like, you don't get private testing sessions to figure it out. You only have on-track time in front of everyone else to go, here's this new thing we're trying. Boy, I hope it works. Yeah. And if it doesn't.
And maybe it works at one, and then the other one, you're like, oh, it's a little too humid here. Shoot. Like, that kind of throws a wrench in this.
And that's such a huge difference maker, too, is the location of the tracks. When the temperature of the tracks, the way the tracks operate, some of them have a lot of elevation changes. There's a lot of different weather things, like the tires degrade if it's too hot. They don't get warm enough if it's too cold. Like, and those things that seem like, okay, I'm sure that's not like that is the difference between a car being fighting for a top three position or not even finishing in the top 10. Like those little changes, especially this year, it's the end of a regulation cycle before the new regulations come into effect in 2026. So everyone's figured out kind of what to do. Everyone's really, really close together. So any marginal change could be the difference between anywhere from like 10 to 15 places.
Kate, were you going to say something?
I was going to say like the thing that's really fascinating to me is just like to the just do the Olympics with steroids or, you know, just go to 90s baseball. It's one. It is really interesting though, because I feel like there's a level of ingenuity and craftsmanship that I don't think I've ever really thought about until like, and I do think that was one of the things that Drive to Survive helped me with was to hear people talk about their cars. And then also like, I didn't know this until I went to that NASCAR race. Cause I just really didn't pay attention. Cause this is a real recent thing where I've been watching stuff. I didn't know that they only had one car. I didn't realize that not only are they experimenting with new things and proprietary things, but they only have one car. And if they fuck it up,
Yep.
like it makes the, like, yes, it's an expensive sport, but it is also like, you will kill the first of its kind if you fuck this up. Mm-hmm. And I think that, like, that level of impact and, like, weight of responsibility is really, really interesting, and makes them makes even just like the technology behind it all even more fascinating to me. Mm-hmm. It's exciting. It's exciting.
Yeah. I feel like we, like, thoroughly circled, like, here's why F1 is cool, and here's why you should be into it. But, like, the thing, as I was, like, working on researching this episode, the question that I kind of kept circling back to for me was, like, well, why not NASCAR? Like, why is America getting this boom for Formula One when we have our, you know, homebrew, we have Formula One at home, we have NASCAR. And, like, why do we save this energy for this other sport, not for the one that we have here? And so, like, I mean, do you guys have any thoughts on that, like, as we get into that conversation?
Personally, like, despite the fact that everybody in this damn country likes to vote for the 1%, we don't like being presented the 1% doing things. Mm. And I think that that is what Formula One looks like, and why it's taken so long, because it's not approachable, even though NASCAR is still really freaking expensive. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not some cheap thing. I do think that, like, NASCAR for me, before I, like, listened to other people who watch it, I was like, oh yeah, this is just like Larry the Cable Guy shit. Like, this isn't, yeah. I care about. It's the butt of every joke. And then you actually realize how much money people are spending to be at a NASCAR race and to camp mm-hmm. at a NASCAR race and all this stuff. And when you add it up, it's like, well, there really isn't as astronomical a difference as you would think. It's just one is in a suit and one is in cutoff jorts.
Yep.
But they both have the same money. And I think when you kind of remove the class assumptions that come into play, then you understand it more, right? Yeah. And I think that that is something that is fascinating to me. I think the only other thing that I found out from my friend who lives in Europe and has been to races in Europe is finding out the Formula One drivers turn a different way than they in the US than they turn when they race internationally, and how that messes with some drivers. Huh. I don't remember if it's right or left, but it's just like they make them go the opposite way because it's what NASCAR does. Kyle, weigh in. I don't remember the context. I just remember that it was a very big joke because, like, Europeans hated it.
I had never really caught on to that. I do know that some tracks have different, like, some go clockwise, some go counterclockwise. So it is different in terms of type of skill, but there's also a lot of, like, the way the turns work. It's not like you're just always making one type of turn. There's a lot of, you're making multiple types of turns within different corners. And so
turning left is not accurate.
Correct. In Formula One, it's very different. There's a lot of different, like, you go down a long straight and then you turn right for a little bit, but then there's a quick turn back to the left, a little, like, kind of snake that chicane that you go through. So there's a lot more complexity and a lot more variety between the tracks. Obviously in NASCAR, most of the races are on ovals. So it's a fairly straightforward, you go straight for a little bit, go left, go straight for a little bit, go left. And it's just the same thing. They do have some road courses and they have, like, a Chicago street course. I don't know if there's others, not super into NASCAR, but they definitely have tried to branch out from that. But Formula One is just there's all sorts of weird turns and different ways of approaching how the tracks are built. And because a lot of these tracks too are also historic, a lot of them have been around for, you know, they race in the streets of Monaco, which they've been doing for 70 years, Silverstone in England, which they've been doing. That was their very first race in 1950. Like, a lot of this is historic stuff that they've been doing from the beginning with a lot of upgrades and changes, but they've kept the general feel of it the same.
Which even as you were saying that, the thing that triggered my head of, like, as we're talking about, like, the class and culture and perceptions is, like, when someone's like, oh, we were racing in Monaco versus, like, Daytona. It's like,
which I will say, to be the annoying American who has gone to Europe finally.
Yeah.
It is so wild that we as Americans, Which isn't saying like the Monaco track is expensive, but talking with my European friend, he was like, oh yeah, I paid like $150 and I went for a day while I was like here doing a film festival. And I was like, what the hell? But yeah. Like, I feel like we build up European cities because we don't live there in such a way that makes us think that is so much more exorbitantly expensive. When I can say it cost me the same amount of money. Well, not me. They flew me out. But like the trip to Rome was only, I think, $700 more than a trip to San Francisco for GDC. The hotels would have been cheaper. And I think that, like, when we actually put in perspective how large the U.S. is and how stupid expensive everything is here, like, I will never get over the fact that I could buy two coffees for €3.
That's, the yeah, that's unheard
coffees.
Of here.
Here, no, that doesn't happen. I and so
a coffee shop I went to in college, it was like $4 for black coffee and still costs like 50 cents for a refill. And that's the closest I can get to what you just laid out.
Yeah. And like, and I think that like there's this, Americans are very bad at either making something that is foreign the worst thing in existence and worth nothing, like we do with the Global South, or so exorbitantly expensive that we can never reach that or go there like we do with Europe.
Yeah.
And that is a very big American problem. And I think that that contributes to how we view something like Formula One. Because my friend was like, oh, yeah, I went to a Monaco race once. I was like, oh, how much money was that? He was like, it was $150 or €150.
You're like, oh, that's like cheaper than, than an arena concert here.
Oh, yeah. Like I like, going to go see BTS is $600 for one person. Like, I could go to Monaco.
And I don't know if you saw this in the notes. I did write in here, America needs to unpack its weird relationship with when Europe is admirable and trendy versus when it's a socialist hellhole. Like, we have such a weird perception of it where we're like, this part's fancy and this part is garbage. And yeah, like, I think so much of this just boils down to, like, cultural perception. Like it's seen as international and exotic. And like you said, like, that's a thing that we like, I mean, borderline fetishize of like going overseas is like, like a status symbol of like, you left the continent, which it's like, it's a continent. There's so much stuff here without you having to get on a plane or a boat.
Well, the US isn't a continent.
Well, sorry. I mean, North America is a continent. Like there is a ton here without, I mean,
yes,
there are European countries that are half the size of American states, and yet we're just like, oh, but you like haven't left the country.
I think we can fit like 5 countries inside Texas, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, if I remember right, the Netherlands is like the size of the Olympic Peninsula and Washington State, and it's like it's a third the size of Washington State. And all that to say is just like, part of it is like, we gotta like appreciate the things that we have, because I do think there is a varied culture and landscape in America. And like, when it comes to this, like, I think because I think going back to like the whole NASCAR thing is, we also see NASCAR as being tied to a specific like redneck, you know, whatever, like, even though like we talked about, like, it's still like a mental calculus, like intense race situation. It's different because it's like it's a marathon. Like, is it the Daytona that's like 6 hours long?
So they're all like several hours long. They are much longer watches, much longer commitments.
Yeah. And it's like, so those drivers are, I think, a good example. And we, Kyle and I talked about this before recording, is South Park did an episode on NASCAR. And the whole joke of it is that Cartman thinks that it is just turning left and it's easy and it's nothing. And then every pre-race interview is people like laying out like all of their concerns about like the cars, the materials, whether or not this component's going to hold out. What do we think about fuel ratios? And it's like, oh, right. This actually, like, this is, the cars look like our cars. And so we don't take it seriously. And it goes, you know, I don't know. Did I set something off for you, Kate?
No, like, it's crazy because it is, like, it's funny how, like, we believe in American exceptionalism until it comes to this racing thing. It's like, oh,
Yeah, it's like, oh, I could do that, which I, so.
NASCAR is dirt, F1 is gold.
Yes, and it's.
And it is nothing other than that. It is foreign, and, well, I guess the cars are technically.
The cars are a different shape. And, well, so what we talked about before you had hopped on was, like, I think it's this extension of like pre-automobile America, where it was like, oh, like, this is my horse, we have a special bond. And now people like apply it to cars and they're like, if you just get me behind the wheel, I can feel the engine and connect with it and I can drive it. And it's like I said about F1, no, you can't, not like that. Like, you.
Well, I will say too, like, does part of this come with that working man ethos that got beat into the American car system through places like Chevy and Ford? Like, that,
that's
like
a good question.
That is ultimately what it is. Like, a car is for work. A car is like American muscle, and like it all kind of goes towards these achievable things you can buy, but ultimately, like, it's not fancy.
Yeah.
Even American muscle cars aren't considered fancy ultimately. Like, they're not, like, they're status symbols, but like, they're not the same status symbol as a Beamer or a Jag. Like, all of our luxury cars aren't American.
Yeah. So I talked earlier about going to a racetrack and riding in like an old NASCAR practice car. When I was there, right before I got there, some guy who had just bought a Corvette, still had the paper plates on it, like the paper license plate, managed to put all four corners of that car into a wall. Just dinged it on all four corners. And
so
it's
Americans,
like,
shouldn't have nice things.
Right.
Actually.
Going back to, it's like, you can't drive like that. You think you can drive like that. You can't drive like that.
Like, if there's a little bit of water, I'm terrified of hydroplaning.
Oh, yeah. I've hydroplaned in a two-door Honda Civic. It was not a great experience.
Also, one of the things that was insane to me in, again, F1 Academy, watch it, was one of the sisters had PTSD from breaking her arm on a steering wheel.
That's insane.
Because she was holding it, and you're supposed to let go because the force will break your wrist. Like... that was insane to me. Or there's this other one where they were like at a pool or something, and I think it was a rally car girl, like, goes to grab something. I'm like, those are huge biceps. What is this? And then I'm like, oh no, you have to be fit.
Yeah, as much as it feels like people are just sitting in a car for, you know, their 6 hour laps or their hour and a half race in F1, like, it's a physical endurance thing, like, from the G forces to the length, the focus, everything. I think kind of like bringing it all to like more of a point is like the reason that all of this is popular is that, like, I think racing is maybe one of our most popular competition formats. Like, if you really think about it, like, how much of the Olympics comes down to racing people in some capacity? And especially America, like, we love going fast. Like, even though it's like the working man thing, like, how is it the Hellcat? It's a commercially available muscle car that has like 400 or 500 horsepower or something, more than you would ever realistically need in the United States to go anywhere, because we don't have an Autobahn.
Room.
But we sell it because we're like, yeah, don't you want a car that could go fast?
I mean,
like,
we
doesn't
do
that sound
have
nice?
I-10 cutting going through Texas. That's close to an Autobahn.
Oh, that's fair. Yeah. I think it's just that, like, at least for F1, it's also, to me, and this is, you know, maybe not everyone, I feel like the out engineering each other component of it is especially interesting and really cool, where it's like, hey, like, not like we are not just pushing our drivers and our fuel mixtures. Like, we are literally trying to figure out new ways through the air, like new aerodynamics to win.
So this is going to be funny.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a webtoon that I read, and it was a little smutty romance, but it was Formula One based. I found out that the writer really loved Formula One, and one person was a driver, and one person was an engineer. And the driver was like mad because his boyfriend, who was the engineer, was getting poached by teams. And he was like, well, why don't they want me too? And it's like, because he builds really good cars, and now he's going to go to Germany for a year. It's very stupid, but then I started watching Drive to Survive and everything else, and I was like, oh yeah, engineers are really important.
Yeah. Also, I was wrong. The 2023 Dodge Hellcat had 807 horsepower.
Oh, okay.
By comparison, I think my Honda Fit has like 130. So it is 8 Honda Fits taped together.
Well, I wonder
how
who
many
would win in a race.
Can,
I think one of the things you touched on too in talking about all that, like the class, Kate, you mentioned that like NASCAR is similarly expensive. It is similarly, a lot of that too just comes down to the way we as Americans view paying high prices for sporting events, yeah, or any type of, like, races. The race in Monaco is expensive, not tickets necessarily, but being in Monaco is expensive. Most of the races that are on like purpose-built circuits are out in the middle of nowhere, outside of small towns and small areas, kind of like a lot of the NASCAR races are. But there's such a sporting culture in Europe. It's been a big thing with soccer in the last couple of years. Now that they're playing the Club World Cup here this summer in the States, they're seeing how expensive tickets are, and they're like, this is outrageous. If you say you're going to raise ticket prices by $2 in England, there's riots.
We will tear down your stadium.
Yeah, it is. It is such a, and it's taken as an offense to the fan. Like, we give so much to be here. How dare you make this inaccessible? So it's, we see the glitz and glamour of F1 when they do Monaco or Las Vegas or Miami, and you see all the celebrities coming out of the woodworks to be there. But most of the races are in places where, I mean, I did the math. It is cheaper for me to fly to Italy to go to one of the races in Italy, like get a hotel and a 3-day weekend pass for the race, flights and everything, than it is for me to drive 3 hours down to Miami and attend the race. I think that changed this year. I think tickets got a little cheaper, but like the first 2 years,
it was insane.
Like, that's ridiculous, but it's because it's a, to be able to go to a thing. And here people see, oh, I have to pay $300 for a ticket. That's nothing. I remember when, here with the Orlando soccer team, the Major League Soccer team, they were playing against Inter Miami, and Messi was supposed to be here, and they were like, he didn't come. But there were these families on the news. This mom was like, I paid $4,000 for me and my kids to come to this game. And I'm like, normally you pay $15 and come to a game. Like, what is, why is it that people do that and they feel like this is right? No, it's just,
I was gonna say, for college football, the Texas Aggie game, like the Texas A&M game last year, which is the first time playing in conference, I think it was $1,900 per ticket, which was the most expensive of any college sporting event.
Yeah. I mean, how many people do you know
in College Station?
Well, it's like going to the Super Bowl. Like, the average person is never going to be able to afford to go to the Super Bowl.
You have to win a lottery to be eligible to buy a ticket to go to the Super Bowl. And then it's still like 10 grand.
Yeah. It's such a uniquely American thing where we, and a lot of times it's people who can't afford to pay those prices are doing it because it's played up to be like NASCAR is played up to be, this is the working man's racing series. Mm-hmm. And so when they get talked into paying these absurd prices, they don't see that as a problem, because culturally we're so ingrained to this idea, mm-hmm, of if something is more expensive, it must be more worth it. Like, the price going up is a good thing, and me making the sacrifices to pay this is somehow, mm-hmm, a good thing, even though the sport doesn't need that extra $100-$150 per ticket. Yep. The sport could be sustainable if it was affordable, but why would you care about that when you have, you're able to condition people to believe that paying those kind of prices is normal and good because yay capitalism.
Yeah. Well, and that's also, you are convincing people that the live experience is that much different. And I'm not going to say the live sports are not different from watching on TV. Watching baseball on TV, do not care. Going to a baseball game in person, it's a great time. Like, get a hot dog, have a few beers, hang out with my friends.
Watching
talk.
Four home runs in one inning was insane.
Yeah.
That was my first baseball game.
That's so fun. Like, that's great in person. But yeah, if I'm watching baseball on TV, like,
I also didn't pay for those tickets. My wonderful friend, who's a lifelong Dodgers fan, wanted to convert me to Dodgers, and he took us.
That
so
helps. Yeah. But yeah, and so I think, yeah, you're convincing someone like, oh, going to this major race in person, it's $4,000 better than watching it on TV.
Well, which, and it's in,
that's its own conversation.
Yeah. Well, it's also crazy too, because like I'm a diehard college football fan, and I, for Austin home games or UT home games in Austin, because I'm alumni, I can pay $90 a person. And mm-hmm, it's tailgating, but it's unlimited food, unlimited drink until the start of the game, mm-hmm, in the Alumni Center, which, oh, that sounds interesting. But I'm like, I'm not even going to the game if I do that. I'm not paying that money, and I'm not doing that because I'm poor and I love my team, but I can go get drunk down the street for half the cost,
yeah.
Like, paying it myself and be in an environment that is like equally as conducive mm-hmm. to rooting for or against things. And I think that like it, but it is a status symbol because I have friends who will pay that nonstop. He's like, oh, well, it's the Alumni Center. Now I'm here as an alumni. Like that is something that like, and we feed into it. And sometimes you need to just be a socialist hellhole so you can afford to go see your sporting events. Like, and I don't believe they're a socialist hellhole.
No.
Everybody else does. But guess what? They have healthcare and it is €3 for two coffees.
And that I will sounds take great. It. Yeah. And $150 for a race. So.
Yes.
But yeah, I think really like it. I don't want to pass a huge judgment on NASCAR because I did not research NASCAR as heavily as I did F1 for this. But I do feel like the F1's popularity is that it's a better value proposition. It's less of your time. It's less of your mental energy, but it's still like an amazing thing at the end of the day. And like good product and good marketing, like that's going to be successful. Like they made a calculated buy when like Liberty Media, when they bought F1. And I think it's paying off. Like, I think they're leveraging a cool thing and building out the audience in a way that is, I would say, like, I'm reluctant to say deserved because I know that this is a bunch of rich people building cars that I'm never going to get to touch or see. And I should have the class warfare part of me is just like, don't say anything positive about F1. But also I'm like, no, like you guys made a cool thing and you're making it accessible to people. Because you had mentioned subscribing to F1 TV. How much is that?
Oh, I want to say it's like, let me see. I got to double check this because I don't want to like get wrong. I want to say it was like $50 for a year, but I could be wrong. No, sorry. It is $130 for the full year to get like the premium to be able to watch all the races live. There's 24 races this year, I believe. So that's
okay.
I'm bad at math.
So there's not even that many races in a year.
No, because there's so much travel. They do them all over the world. Mm-hmm. Like you'll
well,
have
I guess
a race.
It is like when each race is an hour and a half, being like there's not that many is not fair.
Yeah. Well, and they're if they're racing, you know, 24, 25 weeks out of the year, that is almost half the year. And the season goes from preseason testing in February to the last race in the beginning of December. It is definitely an all year. A lot of the reason it's so spread out is because of the logistics of getting everything you need for a race weekend transported from, let's say, they were racing in Canada a couple weeks ago, and then they went over to Austria, and then they go to England, and then they go to Belgium, and then there's races in the Middle East, there's races in Australia, Singapore, China, Japan, mm-hmm. the US, Canada, Mexico, like they're all over the place. So there's a lot of logistics when it comes to doing that. They are trying to change the calendar to make it so it's more, instead of crisscrossing the globe, it's like, hey, let's do this whole region in one swing. But it's very spread out. But it is like, so F1 TV is like, if you pay for that, you can watch every race, every session, so all the practice, whatever. It's also all aired on ESPN. Oh, so okay. If you have ESPN, you can watch the practice sessions. I'll be up tomorrow morning. The day we're recording this is on a Thursday. I'll be up tomorrow morning at 7:30 to watch the practice session because it'll be on ESPN or ESPN2 or whatever, but all the races are aired on either ESPN or ABC. So it's super accessible to be able to get on and watch those without having to pay extra. The paying extra is like, I mean, it's better quality. You can also watch like the F2, F3 and other things, but even then $130 for a year divided by 24, 25 races. I mean, it's not an outrageous amount of money versus if you want to buy NFL Sunday ticket and you're paying $500-$600 or NBA yeah. League Pass, which I think has gotten cheaper, but it's still, all of those are just ridiculously expensive to access.
This red is zone.
Yeah. Like it's, you almost have to sell a kidney to be able to watch a lot of these other sports. Whereas here there is for most people an easily accessible option, or there's an option to go pay, you know, a bit to go watch the full season.
I tried looking up NASCAR subscription prices, and all I found was something about $140 for this part of the season. And I was like, oh, I'm checked out. If it's $140 for part of the season, like, I mean, and that's also the weird thing. Like we talked about it already, but of like this is like the working man's sport, but then also it is unreasonably expensive to watch or participate in.
Yes.
Yeah, I think they're on Fox, which IndyCar is also now on Fox, which is really done well. IndyCar is basically American F1. It's open wheel racing. It's not quite as popular, but they have the Indy 500, which is considered one of the most impressive races out there.
One of two races I could name as a child.
It's become more accessible to watch a lot of those things. A lot of it has been, though, you talked about, like, F1 has marketed themselves really well. NASCAR has not. It's gotten better in recent years, but it hasn't really tried to market itself outside of that small town southern approach. I mean, they do it, it's one of the reasons that I have trouble even with IndyCar, which I love. The whole pre-race, there's like a pre-race prayer and like a lot of nationalist stuff that I'm just kind of like, this really takes me out of kind of the experience. Like, this is very clearly for one set of people, and it's a little uncomfortable if you don't fit in that set. Yeah. I won't say that like the fan base is always cultivating that, but there are corners of that. Whereas F1 is doing the most that it can. Like, every country it goes to, you're getting the anthem by like a local, whether it's a band or performers or singer or whatever. Like, you're getting that stuff, but it's not as down your throat, and it's a much different experience that's, I think, meant to be more. When they are giving you something from this country, it's because they want you to see what it's like. They want you to see, like, the Austrian race. Hans Zimmer did, like, the F1 title theme, like, did his own, like, arrangement of it and performed it. So, like, things like that that they can do and make it interesting and go, hey, here's someone from this country, and they're wanting to do this, and they're wanting to show how much it means, whereas the American aspect of it is very clearly trying to portray a specific subset of culture. Even if I don't think necessarily the fan base is all, I mean, the reputation is people who watch NASCAR are just poor rednecks. And that's not accurate. That's not what most of the fan base is, but that's the image that they have. And they've not really done enough to distance themselves in that. Whereas F1 had this image of, this is the spoiled rich white guy sport. And they've really gone out of their way to try to make it more accessible and show that, yes, a lot of these drivers are spoiled rich white guys. But they're not all. Yeah. You have Lewis Hamilton, who's the greatest driver of all time, who had to, the sacrifices his family had to make to get him into racing and being the first ever black Formula One champion and now winning 7 times. And then his investment back into the sport and trying to get more access for people that won't, you know, that don't have opportunities similar to his experience. And he's not the only one. Sure, there's people that buy their way in, but it's slowly changing. And also with things like F1 Academy, they're going out of their way to really show, we're not just saying we want this to be different, but we're putting our money where our mouth is.
Yeah, I like that. I feel like that wraps it up for me really nicely.
That's a beautiful way to wrap it up. Yeah.
I was like, if anyone has any more closing thoughts, but I feel like that's the spot.
My last closing thought is, I'm happy that Kyle ended this so articulately.
Same.
However, Lewis Hamilton is also really fucking hot. I looked up pictures of Formula One people without their shirts on because I was like, oh, they got muscle. He's also really hot.
And here on But Why, though, we stand by, hot people are hot.
Exactly.
And we are good with it. We are into it. All right, that does it for this week. If you want more listening at home, we have it. We are a whole website, butwhytho.net. You can also find us on Blue Sky under that name, and you can subscribe to our newsletter. It's free. You can donate, that's money, by going to butwhytho.net/support. Both of those things help us to keep the site running and are beneficial to us, so I would strongly encourage you to do that. Everything that you give keeps the site running, helps us pay our writers, helps us keep the lights on. Kate, Kyle, thank you guys so much for joining me. I learned a lot about F1. I need to go watch F1 Academy and Drive to Survive and immerse myself in this more. Thank you at home for listening. We'll see you next week.